This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of a four-part mini-series of the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, where EFL department leads provide a unique insight into the workings of the organisation and explain some of the key roles and functions of the world's original league competition. What is it the Football League does? How do they do it and why? Inside the walls of the EFL on this mini-series edition of the official EFL podcast. So on this particular episode, we are talking about fixtures and we're talking about broadcasting. How are a team's fixtures determined? What considerations are made when compiling the fixture lists, and how does it all dovetail into broadcasting and streaming? To take us through this one, we've got the EFL's competitions manager, Paul Snellgrove, and chief commercial officer, Ben Wright. And we'll kind of, guys, run this as two chats. I think we'll go competitions first, broadcast second, but I'm assuming, Ben, there's lots of overlap between you two. I'm guessing you two are on the phone to each other most days, are you, about some little anomaly or fixture switch or game put across for television?
Yeah, I think you're probably right, Mark. I mean, I think there is a very close relationship between how the calendar is compiled and how that then relates to what matches are selected for broadcasting, and the whole compilation of the fixture list and how that then is put together determines how we can approach that with our broadcast partners. So yeah, the two dovetail pretty closely.
Yeah, so as the season's reaching a climax and things, and you're all excited thinking, oh, we're really fulfilling to broadcast partners here, Ben, Snelly's got the opposite approach, which is you suddenly give him a big fat bundle with loads of rescheduling to be done and things like that. Am I right, Paul?
Not far off, yes. Obviously, the fixture list as we go through a season is a bit like a spider's web. So obviously the rescheduling of fixtures will then have a knock on to other fixtures during midweeks, during weekends. And it's basically a case of making sure it's fair to everybody. Yeah. Whilst also obviously fulfilling the contracts with Sky and obviously making sure the right games are on live, and the narrative of the season is portrayed, and the most important fixtures are live on Sky.
Yeah, I wanted to get the sort of interdepartmental dynamic out there, but obviously there's serious issues to discuss, and what we're seeking to do here is to demystify a lot of the processes. So I mean, Paul, do you want to give us the basics of how you compile the EFL fixture list, what, in the close season, or are you already sort of scheming and shuffling and moving little pieces of paper and counting your fingers and toes once the turn of the year comes?
Well, to go from the very start of the process, we sort of work three or four seasons in advance, setting calendars and schedules, FIFA set international dates around 3 or 4 years in advance. Obviously, UEFA are looking that far in advance as well with their dates. We're constantly updating calendars and schedules, going forward well into the next 2, 3, 4 seasons. In terms of any one season, we will have a joint fixture schedule prepared with the FA and the Premier League, who we work very, very closely with. That will happen around about November in any one year, ahead of the following season, when we're juggling dates with the FA and end of season and playoffs and things like that.
I just want to be clear for the listeners' point of view, you're talking about actual dates when there will be fixtures. We're not talking about in any way pulling together teams at this point. We're just talking about your headline stuff. There will be football on this date, not this date, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And obviously that's for each division. We then move on from November into March, where we will put that schedule in front of clubs. We'll ask for views, comments on that. Obviously, we're placing midweek rounds in then. So, you know, clubs are given an opportunity to feed back into us. We will then go into meetings with our fixtures group, our fixtures working party, which consists of a cross-section of clubs across all divisions. And again, that is to set any policies, procedures, sign off the schedule, the calendar, like you say. And it's then we move into the more detail where we liaise with each club, ask them to give us any date requests, any pairing changes, any sort of non-specific things, if they want to, you know, ensure their Saturdays are maximised in certain periods of the season, because they may have, you know, work on a stand or an area they can't use for a period. So we delve really deep into the detail of what clubs want, basically, because we want to ensure that the fixture list is fair to all 72 clubs.
Yeah, and even specific events, rival events that might be going on to the football in a city or a town on a certain weekend.
Absolutely, it's a huge part of it, and you know that there are normally approximately 80 to 90 separate date requests each season. This season, because of the nature of it and the fact that clubs really haven't had a proper break until this summer, there's been a huge increase really in date requests in the early part of the season, because they want to get on the pitches and do the maintenance work and the relays that were all held over from last summer. So there's been a big increase in events as well that are obviously cancelled during the lockdown period have then been moved into this year. So we're almost seeing a doubling up of half marathons and sort of festivals and things like that. So it's been a bit of a challenge this season getting all the date requests in.
And just to clarify as well, Ben, and not just to keep you involved in the conversation, but actually genuinely, might when you have such a key broadcast partner as Sky, might they get involved early in the protocols as well and go, do you know what, it would suit us not to do a fiesta of football this weekend because we're covering the Oscars? Or, I mean, would they get involved at this stage as well in the very headline stuff?
No, they don't, Mark, to be honest. I mean, you know, in terms of what they're entitled to and how that fits with the actual outline calendar that Paul's talked to you about, that's pretty well predetermined. Right. Both within the contract with Sky and within the relationship. So they tend to know, you know, exactly how the calendar's going to fit. They've obviously got agreements with other football bodies that also cross over that. And so it tends to be less about, at that point, you know, key weekends for them that far out or key particular slots that far out. And that what you're alluding to probably takes place a little bit more closer to the start of the season or during the season.
Yeah. Gotcha. Paul, pairings. Do you want to explain how they work? Because that's a really key sort of element of your work.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key factors in the fixture list is not giving clubs problems down the line. We want to ensure that that the season runs as smoothly as possible. For as many clubs as possible. So we do engage with police forces up and down the country, and I mean every single police force, not just the major ones. And a good example would be the Sheffield clubs, in that, you know, South Yorkshire Police would not want Sheffield Wednesday and Sheffield United with a home fixture on the same day. So we ensure as far as possible that one is at home and one is away each week. Same for Port Vale and Stoke, you know, and any number of two club cities, basically. There's also multiple club areas, such as, you know, the West Midlands, for example. The police won't be very happy if there was five home games one Saturday and one home game the next. So we try and ensure a sort of a fair spread, that's 3 and 3 or 4 and 2, along those lines, and that's maintained throughout the season.
Yeah. So those are a couple of the anomalies. The other ones obviously are home v away fixtures. Have we got a formula for that? Because I'm assuming you don't want somebody to suddenly have four or five home games in a row 1 month and then have to travel extensively the next month. Otherwise, fans and club resources are being stretched, aren't they?
Yeah, so, I mean, how we actually compile the fixtures, ourselves in the Premier League will jointly liaise with an outside IT contractor called Atos, who we have a very long-standing agreement with and are very competent, and they're certainly full of football fans, put it that way. So they know what ourselves in the Premier League want. You know, they deliver on that season on season. Their algorithm and their software will work to certain compilation rules. So sort of very basic, you know, not three consecutive home or away fixtures, a fair mix of fixtures over five. So three at home, two away and vice versa. And ensuring the home and away sequence on Saturdays is as close to home away as possible. It's not actually mathematically possible to have more than two clubs in any one division following that home and away alternate basis. So there is obviously a number of exceptions to that, but we try and stick as far as possible as we can to that. The complicating factor is midweeks. Obviously, there's a number of midweeks in the Championship and League One and League Two. That will follow a separate home and away sequence because we want to ensure a club's not away on both the Saturdays and at home for the midweek in the middle. So it's really the Saturdays that we prioritise, and then the midweeks will naturally cause a double home or a double away, you know, when they're scheduled.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing talking of midweek is there's a I think there's a lot of misunderstanding because a lot of fans or some fans say, why is my team playing some of its furthest away games in midweek? Because obviously diehard fans want to go to every single game. But there is method in this, what they would deem as madness, Paul, isn't there? Which is you do it by design and you know, you're not fudging this. You're quite open about it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, we liaise with clubs quite extensively on what they want from their fixtures and completely understand, and it's completely justified, I think, sometimes some of the midweek journeys, especially the, you know, your diehard fans that go home and away. I completely understand their complaints, but we need to ensure clubs can maximise their Saturday fixtures. In terms of attendance, and obviously in terms of revenue that they take over the gates, so you know they want their big local fixtures and their well attended fixtures on a Saturday when most season ticket holders can attend, when it's a lot easier for travelling supporters to attend the game, and the upshot of that is that some of the more lengthy midweek journeys you know will occur on a midweek, and it is something we are conscious of, and we do try and ensure a fair spread over the four or five away journeys that clubs are not travelling excessive distances every time they have an away fixture, basically. So we look at them as a group and try and ensure there's a fair spread, but obviously always have to ensure that we're not giving a club a massive local derby on a midweek where, you know, the attendance could be 15, 20% down than it would be on a Saturday.
But just to be absolutely clear, if Gillingham are travelling to Sunderland midweek, the likelihood is that even if it was on a Saturday, there won't be a doubling of away support going. It would only be an incremental increase on the number that would go anyway, even if it was on a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Absolutely, yes. That, you know, that is the sort of the economic reality of it, shall we say. And, you know, very frustrating if fans are getting home at 3 or 4 in the morning. But like you say, it's the attendances that we need to make sure are maximised, and a high profile fixture or a local fixture on the Saturdays is how we do that.
Good. Thanks for explaining. I think we've done it justice. And I think it's good to get that out there, because I think people don't understand that it is done by design for the commercial reasons you've just said. Right, this is the exciting bit. So we've built up, we've got all the little anomalies in place. Who presses the button? All these bits are put into the algorithm, are they? And then literally somebody presses enter and the fixture list starts to come out.
Not far off, yes. Obviously, there's a huge amount of preparation work that goes into it.
Yes, I'm not denigrating your work. You just justified your existence. Ben's nodded away in approbation several times during that. We're okay.
I could show you some very complicated documents that you'd be...
Well, go on, no, explain.
So what needs to be in place first before, you know, the button is pressed is basically a home and away sequence, which will detail... every single combination of home and aways. You'll be able to see this from looking at the fixture list, but it's sort of it's split into what we call sets, so which are roughly 4 or 5 games long. And the opening set, let's say over August, will reverse in, say, January or February. So you'll have a 3 or 4 fixtures, home, away against certain opposition in August, which will then reverse away, home in January or February. And that is how we maintain the pairings across divisions, how we accommodate multiple date requests, because there are clubs with a number of date requests. And it's also how everybody plays everybody home and away, essentially. Yeah. So... Okay. To accompany that, there's what we call a pairing grid.
Okay.
And there is a box for each club, basically, and the date requests and the pairings will determine which box in that grid they go in, which will correspond to a certain sequence of sets, essentially. I may be boring you now.
No, you're not, mate. No, I get it. This is serious stuff. But ultimately, does it come down to a moment where all the little anomalies have been put in your various grids, Paul, and a button is pressed and starts to meticulously pump out the fixtures week by week, club by club?
Essentially, yes, there is. Obviously, like I say, we have a very close working relationship with Atos. So the gentleman who runs the software for them essentially inputs all the information that he needs and codes it into the algorithm as soon as the playoffs are finished in any one season. We've got 4 divisions, or our 3 divisions of clubs, and it's then he can press the button. So a draft fixture list will then be presented to us, and it's then a case of almost pouring through it meticulously, sort of week by week, club by club, to see how we can refine those fixtures to ensure that it makes the clubs easier, lives easier, to be honest, in terms of, you know, we will look at opening sections of the season to ensure there's no huge games there that would spark the interest of the police or the local authorities. The closing sections of the season, we try and minimise travelling distances over the festive period as much as we can. So there are certain elements we can do post those fixtures being produced to refine them. And ensure it's the best fixture list we could possibly give to clubs, essentially.
And Ben, wearing your overall commercial hat, is the sort of hierarchy looking across at this process throughout? Is Paul left to it? And suddenly one day he says, there you go, mate, there's a link, it's all done and dusted. I mean, you know, how does it work into what you do from an overall perspective?
Mark, Paul's been doing this for a long time, is extremely experienced in it, and so knows broadly what he's got to deliver in terms of the requirements of the broadcast contracts. The key bit from my perspective is, as Paul knows, he's got to get his split of weekends and midweeks away, because that's how we've sold the TV matches, which we'll come on to talk about. And then obviously within that, it's his sequencing. So basic stuff, if someone's on TV on a Wednesday night, they can't play on a Friday night. And they're the type of things that Paul has to be aware of, both in terms of the formation of the list and then also as we work through the season.
Gotcha. Just at this moment, I've got to mention, Ben, the pandemic that we've all been through. And particularly in this last year, this last season, I mean, there was no wriggle room, mate, at all, was there? There was absolutely no, and obviously there were reschedules and things, which I'm going to discuss with Paul in a second, but I mean, it was so tight.
It's a well-trodden phrase, Mark, but there's no manual for this one. I think, you know, the priority was to finish the 19-20 season from a championship perspective, which we managed to do. And then obviously we had to give the players a break, albeit a short one, before we could start again. We were starting later, and that meant everything that Paul's just talked to you about in terms of the normal scheduling of that fixture calendar had to be condensed. And so the bulk of that means that we've got to play more matches in a quicker space. And predominantly that meant around championship midweeks, for example. So in a normal season, Paul will schedule 8 sets of arranged midweek matches. You might get some rearranged matches, but there are 8 predetermined sets of midweek matches. To give you an idea of the season we've just finished, we had 13 sets of midweek matches. So you're putting an additional 5 arranged sets of midweeks into that calendar already, which naturally condenses. You then come on to something like the Carabao Cup, where you're looking at a very congested calendar because of those additional midweeks, which obviously the Premier League had got as well. You're then looking at the Champions League, you're looking at the FA Cup. And that meant we had to play, you know, a number of rounds in the Carabao Cup very early in September and through September, which would normally have been spread around September, October and November. So automatically, just from a purely logistical perspective, you've got the impact there of the pandemic on how we had to schedule stuff. That then has a direct commercial impact from my perspective on, are we delivering against the obligations of our broadcasting contract? How does that sit with you know, what we've normally sold, and how do we resolve that? And obviously, I'm sure we'll come on to talk about it, you've got the added complexity of no fans in stadiums, and how do you make those matches available?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, I've said this on most outlets that I work with across BBC Radio and television. I think, and I'm going to do it again now, I think we've got to pay tribute to everybody, have we? Which is you guys, which is the clubs, the players, the managers, the owners, supporters, who a lot of whom left their season ticket money with their clubs or took the sort of iFollow streaming games instead of turning up. For making football happen, Ben, over this period, it's a small miracle. And probably you had moments of panic, didn't you, that we wouldn't get through at all?
No, I mean, I think first of all, I'd completely echo that, Mark. And you know, I think the number of people you meet and speak to that says, well, at least by carrying on playing, that gave some, you know, people something to look forward to in midweek or at a weekend in very difficult times. And okay, they couldn't be at the game, but even the fact that their club was playing gave them something to look forward to in what was an extremely difficult time. Yeah, I think, you know, there were a number of challenges throughout that season, particularly in terms of getting started again and some of the logistical challenges we faced around the protocols and making sure we could adhere to those. And then particularly at the turn of the year when we had the, you know, what was known as the Kent variant spreading very, very rapidly, and we were losing a number of fixtures. And again, I think the clubs and the internal departments at the EFL and all of the players and management, etc., did really well to tighten up on the protocols and the testing to make sure we could get through what was an extremely challenging period at that point in time to get towards being able to complete the season. And it, you know, it was just fantastic to be able to get to a position where playoff final weekend we had supporters at matches. And you know, candidly, we didn't think we'd perhaps even get to that position. And so to have finished the season and then and all 3 divisions and then have fans at those matches, I think was a real achievement.
Indeed it was. Going to drill down into broadcasting in just a second after I've just put to Paul. I mean, postponements in a normal season, I mean, you, having done this job as long as you have, you must look at things from a very different perspective. You know, you're not just looking in terms of one game going like a supporter would, their team not suddenly travelling to Rochdale that weekend. But if you suddenly have a bad bout of weather and a load of fixtures go, your head must be in your hands at times, aren't they?
It has been, yeah. I mean, yeah, certainly last December, as Ben said, it was a particularly difficult one because I think we had a number of COVID postponements, and we had the worst winter for postponements for about 10 seasons. So it was not easy. But in terms of sort of planning those postponements, we are plotting out rearrangements before the season's even started, because you're identifying dates where games for FA Cup runs are going. If we lose a couple over the Christmas period, you're plotting out where they go. Obviously, for League One and League Two, you're plotting out where games lost for international breaks are going. But in terms of the rules that relate to fixture postponements, they don't generally help us. Obviously, the clubs make and vote on the rules. But there's nothing prescriptive other than they've got to be played at the earliest reasonable opportunity. Now, what's reasonable to one club might not be reasonable to the other. So it's a case of finding mutually the best date for that Saturday postponement. And obviously they tend to be midweeks because we're using every Saturday we possibly can. And, you know, naturally things do bottleneck, certainly when you do have a good FA Cup run, which is obviously very lucrative for the club and is very welcome. And you do lose a couple of games for weather. But like you say, you are plotting out those dates that are available and are usable sort of in advance.
Yeah, I think you make an important point as well, which is that at the end of the day, you guys are there, the EFL is there, to maintain the rules and regulations that the clubs set, vote on, any changes. I mean, effectively a trade association like you would have for, I don't know, a parade of shops to maintain facilities. That is your role there. There will obviously be self-interest, as you've just said. Maybe a manager's got an injury crisis. He'd prefer to put it back a month. But ultimately, I guess there are times as well, Paul, where you guys have to take a sterner line and say, no, we've looked ahead. There is a date there. You two can't agree. We're going to have to insist it's played on that day.
Yeah, correct. And an element of that and what you're looking for is ultimately completing the season in good order. Because if we do run out of dates, I've not done my job properly. So it's almost being, to turn a phrase, being cruel to be kind, because, you know, the wheels can come off occasionally. You know, if we do have a bout of freak weather, and it's almost having that in the back of your mind that you might need that spare date up your sleeve, and you know, 7 times out of 10 you do.
Just from a personal satisfaction point of view, when everything's sorted and the fixture list is revealed, or maybe it's the first round of fixtures, or maybe it's getting to the end of the season, is there sort of a personal pride in that? Where's the buzz for you when you're involved so intimately in the compilation of fixtures? What's the moment that you go, my work here is done?
That's a very good question.
You haven't thought about this, have you? I could tell you.
I haven't, no. No, I mean, obviously the culmination of the season with the playoffs, they're always fantastic occasions. They're always, you know, you've been there yourself. They're always fantastic days at Wembley where you can see the thrill of the fans, and the build up to each game is, you know, is huge. So obviously that's a very satisfying element of all our jobs at the EFL and everybody that you know, that's involved in those games. For me personally, I know that the day after I'm straight into fixture compilation. So it's fairly short-lived, but yeah, once each fixture list is out, it is a relief, but you do know that there's issues that aren't perfect that you might need to resolve, and there's a bout of TV selections down the line which could cause you issues, which again you've got to smooth out. So it's bit of a war of attrition sometimes.
You've set that up perfectly for our switch across to broadcasting. Ben, should we just remind everybody where we are broadcast-wise with the various contracts that the EFL currently holds, please, just for those that might not have got the overall picture?
Yeah, no problem. So in the UK, our primary broadcast partner is Sky Sports, as we've referenced. They, in 21-22, will be going into the third season of a five-season deal. So we've got three seasons left with them, finishes at the end of 23-24. That's obviously the bulk of our broadcast output, particularly in the UK. We've got a highlights show with Quest, which is entering its final season in 21-22. And similarly, most of our overseas broadcast agreements, of which were carried by about 43 broadcasters outside of the UK, they end in the summer of 22 as well. So busy summer for me coming up this summer in terms of what we're going to be doing with the highlights and where we're going overseas. But with Sky, another three seasons, so probably a little bit early to be looking at that one. But I'm sure you'll press me on that in a bit, Mark.
Yeah, well, and obviously a hugely important source of revenue after what the country and the 72 clubs have been through. We should mention radio as well, which is obviously the contract with TalkSport, isn't there, for live commentary for the various games and also local BBC radio stations as well. I guess the thing that you must get picked up on a lot is the selection of TV games. Do you want to take us through that process, please, Ben? What triggers what?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's probably worth sort of linking it back to the way that Paul talked about, you know, what constitutes the structure of the calendar throughout the season. For the purposes of this example, I'll focus on the Championship and come into League One and League Two later on. So the way the broadcast contract works is we've sold against either midweeks or weekends. So in the case of the Championship, Sky get 94 weekend matches, 94 Championship weekend matches, which is typically spread across 38 weekends. And Paul will correct me, that includes bank holidays, etc., etc. And then, in addition to that, you've got 8 sets of midweek rounds, and we've got an obligation of 16 matches there. So in total, you've got 110 live Championship matches across the season. There's some bits and pieces around red button and streaming, which we'll come on to, but they're your core matches, Mark. 94 weekend and 16 midweek. And then within that, the slots are broadly predetermined. So take a weekend, for example. Sky have got the ability to pick across a number of different slots. They've got a slot on a Friday night, slot on a Saturday lunchtime, slot on a Saturday tea time, slot on a couple of Sunday kickoff times, and then even a Monday. But typically, if you look at an average Championship weekend, given what other commitments Sky have got, they'll take a game for us on a Friday night, they'll probably take a game from us on a Saturday lunchtime, potentially one on a Sunday lunchtime. So you're looking at about three matches per weekend. And that process winds back from 5 weeks from when those matches are actually selected. So Sky will look at what they want to take. They'll go to Paul and the fixtures team and say, right, we'd like X versus Y on Friday night, team A versus team B on Saturday lunchtime, and team C versus team D on Sunday lunchtime. And then the fun bit starts, because what Paul's got to do is look at, is that feasible from a delivery perspective? So, you know, example, Wednesday, if we've got somebody playing Wednesday night, they can't play Friday night. If we've got somebody playing Sunday, they can't play Tuesday. And they're really the basic challenges around that. But typically, it's built around 94 weekend matches, which is an average of about 3 a weekend, 16 midweeks, which are scheduled on the Tuesday and Wednesday, and broadly for the majority of the season, a 5-week lead time in terms of picks.
The criticism from some fans, obviously, is that some clubs get picked more than others. What do you say to that?
I think that you understand the context of where they come from within that. And I think, you know, in any walk of life, clubs that are perceived as being potentially bigger or having bigger audience reach than others will often get a disproportionate share of audience. You know, that's fact. And if you look at the Premier League, it's the same within that. You know, you wouldn't need me to go and look at are the big six pick more than the rest of the PL clubs. And that's similar with us. So if you look at when we've had your Newcastles in the Championship, Leeds for a long period of time, yes, I think they would be picked fairly regularly. However, I think what Sky do a really good job of is actually trying to tell the story and tell the narrative around what the season looks like. And so, you know, actually, they're looking to tell the stories, and that's either around who's going for the title, who's going for the playoff places, or even where does the relegation shake-up look like. Yeah. So if you look at the tail end of the 2021 season and actually the last weekend of that season, they actually showed matches that were involved in the relegation piece because clearly matters above had been settled. Outside of that, there's actually a commitment to show each club mark at home twice within the Championship. So I think it's a balance. Yes, I understand the criticism that some clubs are picked more than others, and I think I would say that there are elements of that that are correct. But I think also we try and make sure, in conjunction with Sky, that we show a really good balanced picture of what is actually a really competitive division, with any club being able to beat any club, and tell those stories throughout the season.
Yeah, I mean, and just to put my head as a sort of broadcaster on as well, whenever I'm going to look to do a feature, or to even when we're choosing guests a lot for the official EFL podcast, I'm afraid to say it's simple semantics. Once you get into the season and it gets in its flow, you do tend to look at the top and bottom of divisions because they are where the stories is. There's nothing worse from a content point of view, usually, than, I'm afraid to say, mid-table obscurity. And the other aspect of this, obviously, too, is that there is revenue, huge revenue attached to this. And you don't just have the TV deal to service, Ben, but you've got commercial partners as well. And they will obviously want to follow the maximum footfall, won't they?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're quite fortunate in that most of the partners, most of the sponsors that we've got actually buy into supporting 72 clubs.
Yeah.
And buy into the fact that, you know, that is supporting a community proposition across the UK that, particularly in the last year, needs that support. And so I think, you know, they're buying that 72 club platform, if you like. But I think in terms of the broadcast stuff, Mark, the other point to make is just in terms of telling the story and the narrative and that having something on it, it's not just people in the UK who are seeing that. So we've got 175 territories overseas taking championship matches via 43 broadcasters to an audience of around 536 million people on a household reach basis. And so it's important that when we pick with Sky for the UK market, we also make sure that we're telling that story outside of the UK as well. And ultimately, that comes back down to relevance. You know, the great thing about sport, as has been proven time and time again, is that it matters when there's something at stake. And I think the key from that position of telling that story is the relevance of, is that a club who can get in the playoffs at the last minute? Is that a club who need to win this match, otherwise they're relegated? Or is it a club who are playing for the title on the final day of the season? And that's ultimately what we're about. And I think the great thing about our divisions is anybody can beat anybody, and that really helps with that process.
I mean, Paul, the other thing you get criticised for is notice on shifting fixtures for TV, but there is a formula to this. Do you want to just tell us what it, I mean, I've got it written here, but you know what it is, I'm sure, just regarding the notice you have to give at certain points in the season.
So as Ben already touched on, there is a broad sort of 5-week notice period going into any one fixture. Now, that is for the first selection of the the latest tranche of selections. So for week two, it's 6 weeks. Week three, it's 7 weeks. It can be up to 8 weeks. The short notice ones tend to, and I wouldn't say short notice, it does whittle down a little bit towards the end of the season, to 4 weeks and then 3 weeks. But again, that is to ensure that Sky are picking the most relevant fixtures and the biggest fixtures with the most riding on them. So they are few and far between. We do keep those to a bare minimum, and you know the 5 week notice period is fairly well established. Obviously, Sky do have other leagues that they show. The selection period for those can be a fairly lengthy period. We do tend to always follow that, but at a minimum, it is 5 weeks for the vast majority of the season.
Ben, I guess in asking my next question to you, there's probably a two-tier answer. There's a regular season answer to the question I'm going to ask you, and there's obviously a pandemic-related answer. It's about where the priority is in terms of TV revenue or gate receipts. Do you want to give us maybe the regular season answer first of all, and then I think probably the pandemic one will take care of itself, but go for it.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question, and it's one that we're spending a lot of time looking at. So traditionally, the gap between gate receipts and broadcasting from an EFL perspective would actually have been pretty significant in favour of gate receipts. So I think, you know, there's a fairly well-trodden number that we're around about £250 million a season in gate receipts. And if you go back five or six seasons where it would have been broadly at that number, and we would probably be, from a broadcasting perspective, at sub £100 million a season. So clearly, you know, there's a dominant play there in terms of attendances. And that gap's been narrowing. So from a broadcast perspective now, we're probably at around £150 million. And obviously, you know, attendances broadly, ticketing income around £250. So that gap is narrowing. So fundamentally, from a revenue perspective, gate receipts still outweighing broadcasting, but with a trend of that narrowing. But I think more importantly, Mark, you know, we've always been about an attendance-driven league, and about protecting and maintaining attendances. So if you look at the way we schedule a weekend of fixtures, the majority of our fixtures are dated for 3 p.m. Saturday. They are not available for broadcast because they're within what's called blocked hours or Article 48, as you may know. And so that's done to protect attendances and maintain that. And I think ultimately that's what our broadcast partners also buy into. They buy into the fact that, you know, they want to see full stadiums with good atmosphere because that makes for better matches. And, you know, we've just seen what no fans looks like for an entire season. And I think, you know, nobody needs me to say what the difference is. So I think, you know, we are an attendance-based league. I don't see that changing. The gap between ticketing income and broadcasting income is closing. And I think then the question for us moving forward is how do we maintain and grow both of those areas in what is a changing world?
And I guess some supporters, Leagues 1 and 2 supporters, will say, oh, there's too much preeminence on the championship. But I mean, the collective selling has served you well, has it not? And obviously, by being put together with the championship clubs, there is obviously a filter down a percentage of the overall gross take that goes to clubs who might not ordinarily make too much of a dent if they tried to sell their rights individually.
Completely. So the gross income that we bring in gets paid out to all 72 clubs in what we call basic award payments. In a normal season, they're made on a monthly basis. During COVID, we've actually advanced those significantly. So either on 3 or 6 month basis. And that's what has, quite candidly, Mark, kept a lot of our clubs being able to keep playing during that period. And so really, you know, you've got the benefit of the certainty of income and the cash flow, But you've also got the fact that the distribution through the three leagues, you know, as part of the pyramid, helps maintain that competitive balance that means that you don't know which team's going to win week in, week out, and also that clubs can travel through the divisions. So, yes, the bulk of the obligation on the broadcasting contract is for the Championship. There are some elements for League One and Two within that, but ultimately there's a framework in place that makes sure that all of the clubs share in that revenue, and that helps maintain what I think we all love about English football, which is that, you know, that pyramid through the leagues.
How significant is the revenue you derive from the cup competitions too?
Huge. So, you know, Paul's already touched on the FA Cup, which we don't run, but is vitally important for our clubs, particularly if they get a good cup run. But from our perspective, the Carabao Cup in particular is hugely important for EFL clubs. That forms a significant proportion of how we sell our broadcasting rights in the UK and overseas, that helps us make guaranteed payments to EFL clubs. We also derive sponsorship revenue from it. And the clubs themselves, again, if they have a good run in that competition, particularly if they draw, for example, a big PL club at home or away, we'll give them additional unbudgeted ticketing income. So you're talking about, you know, tens of millions of pounds that are going to EFL clubs from that competition alone, that helps sustain them. If you then look at the Papa John's Trophy, the EFL Trophy, again, that's deliberately set up to aid and benefit League One and League Two clubs financially, providing them with a direct source of revenue, which is, again, of critical importance. So overall, as part of the economic and sporting aspects of what the EFL provides, cup competitions are critical.
Yeah. I wonder how much of a sea change we've had over the last 18 months with iFollow and with club streaming. Do you want to sort of summarise the sort of changes we've seen, Ben, and I guess the likely impact moving forward, and certainly obviously helping to not fill the total gap of lost gate revenue, but certainly give a little bit of comfort in dark and difficult times?
Yeah, if you don't mind, Mark, I'll go back a little bit in history just to provide a little bit of context. So actually, we've been streaming matches since 2017 outside of the UK. And so that's when we first started streaming matches, because we realised that the 3 p.m. window that's in place in the UK market wasn't in place overseas. And actually, we had lots of fans overseas who, if the clubs weren't put on the broadcast platforms, couldn't see the matches. So that's why we set the streaming service up originally back in 2017. And we've actually got around about 70,000 supporters who pay either weekly, monthly or annually to see their club outside of the UK on the streaming platforms. We then sort of moved into the new broadcasting contract that we've got with Sky, that started in 2019-20. And that gave us more opportunities to stream matches. There were some opportunities for Championship clubs, but also opportunities for League One and League Two clubs that you asked about earlier on. So they were able to stream the matches as well. So we already had the infrastructure in place. And so I guess the one, it's very difficult to talk about benefits of what's happened in the last 18 months or COVID, because I'm not sure any of us would say there were benefits. But the one element of, call it fortune if you want, is that we had this infrastructure in place when COVID hit, whereas a lot of others didn't. We knew that we had the ability to make the matches available. And of course, unfortunately, we had no choice, because clearly no fans could get into stadiums. So you've got broadly three areas that I think the streaming aspects benefited by making all of those matches available. Firstly, you know, it allowed fans to see their clubs play in really difficult times and circumstances, and I think that was a lifeline to those supporters. And then from a club perspective, it helped with two additional aspects, really. One was giving season ticket holders access. So you've talked earlier on about a number of season ticket holders leaving their money within the club to support their club, which I think was fantastic and really kept our clubs going. So again, for home matches, those season ticket holders were given free access to a stream. And then in addition, for away matches, there was the opportunity to buy those matches on a paid for basis. And so you're looking at clubs generated around about another £45 million worth of income during the 2020-21 season. And if you think about the offset in terms of not having to pay back season ticket monies plus that revenue generation, that's going some way towards the £250 million of lost gate receipts that we talked about. It's not going all the way, Mark, and that's why we've had to have help in other areas in terms of furloughing staff, in terms of, you know, grants from the likes of the Premier League, in terms of us advancing the basic award payments that I talked about earlier on. But it's certainly made a real difference. And I think ultimately, you know, in very unusual circumstances, kept that connection between the clubs and their supporters, which has been absolutely critical.
The idea behind this mini-series was to try and demystify what goes on at the EFL. I you've made me aware over the time that we've spent together of the levels of complexity. Guys, lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much for sharing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of the official EFL podcast, looking at some of the inner workings of the EFL, its role, its functions, and its responsibilities. Thanks to competitions manager Paul Snellgrove and chief commercial officer Ben Wright. Watch out for other episodes when we'll continue our unique insight into the key functions of the organisation. Until then, I'm Mark Clement. Thanks for listening to this mini-series edition of
the official EFL podcast.